Proceed to the second case of the day, United States versus McGee et al.
May it please the court.
Mr. Nash.
Judge, we have three lawyers arguing this morning. I will argue the general evidentiary issues that are raised in the joint brief. Mr. Brayman will address the sentencing issues, and Ms. Domp will address the issues pertaining to her client. As to rebuttal, we will split it according to how the government addresses our arguments, if that's okay with the court.
You were reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, we have, between us.
Yes.
The first point that I would discuss with Your Honor is the question of the witness's version of the offense, which is often, and in this case was, contained in the pre-sentence report, which the district court denied to us. The government responds to our argument that this is clearly classical, by definition, 3500 material, by citing the case Dansker from the Third Circuit, 1976. And that case, viewing pre-sentence reports as they were almost 30 years ago in a different vein than they are today, Dansker had submitted a written statement which he had signed and was contained in part of the pre-sentence report. And they seemed, the court there, both the district court and then the Third Circuit, viewed pre-sentence reports in some way sacrosanct beyond the purview of 3500. With all due deference to the court then, they were wrong. These statements, if they're made by the defendant or approved by the defendant or adopted by the defendant, are classical 3500 material. There is no reason for protecting them. In fact, there's every reason for putting them out in the public domain to ensure the integrity of the sentencing processes of the district court. Those are statements that those witnesses make or approve or accept regarding the events about which he's testifying. He should not be able to tell the sentencing judge one thing about the events in question and tell the jury and the defendant in the trial of our case something different. It's not a question of giving those to the district court for an evaluation of whether it is anything impeaching. As was made clear in the Jinks case and many cases since, the only one that can really, truly tell whether that will be helpful to his defendant and his case is defense counsel. And if we look at what Judge Frankfurter said in United States versus Palermo, decided, I believe, in 1959, sometime after Jenks, he said that what the Congress had done in passing the Jenks Act after the Jenks decision was to eliminate, as best it could, the need for a judicial interpretation, as had been done by the court in Jenks, for judicial interpretation of what the defendant should have available. And if we're going to place defendant's versions, because that's what we're talking about, beyond the pale of 3500, then that should be done in the legislature. Because the legislature has spoke, it did not create an exemption for PSRs, and every court that has interpreted the question of what is a written statement of the witness or approved or adopted statement of the witness had said those should be available. The second point I would like to make has to do with Allen's letters to the prosecutor. This is classical evidence that the defense could have shown the bias of the witness for the prosecution. And it becomes even more important when we remember that this witness, Allen, had told the FBI that he had attempted to coach two other prospective witnesses, two cooperating co-conspirators, Maverick Tillman and Eddie Walton, as to what to tell the prosecution and as to the amount of drugs in question. In his letters to the prosecutor, Allen tells the prosecutor, I'll do whatever's necessary. I'll do whatever I can. I want to go home. I want to see my family. My mother has health problems and I want to go home, and you don't understand how far I will go. He told the FBI how far he would go. He would coach other witnesses. None of that reached the jury. In this case, the focal point, at least from my point of view, for Mr. Banks was, I had to impeach the credibility of Allen. If the jury believes Allen, my client, who's entered a plea of not guilty, contested the allegations, I can't win. But I can't contest Allen's credibility if I can't show his bias, if I can't show that he coached other witnesses. The government says that because one lawyer was able to bring out that he coached the witness, that that's sufficient. What did he coach him about? How many times did he? What other witnesses did he coach? We weren't able to probe that fact that he coached the witness. We were immediately cut off. All the other lawyers who followed Mr. Ector's lawyer, who was only to get a smattering of that coaching in, were precluded. All the other lawyers were precluded from bringing out the letters. The letters should have been before the jury. I ask you to read those letters. Those letters set up a natural bias. We're not talking about what the government did here. We're talking about the state of mind of Mr. Allen. And those letters set it out in spades for us. And none of that got before the jury. Another issue with regard to that I think we have to keep in mind. This was a joint trial. It was not a joint defense. We were obligated, because of the trial court's ruling, to accept Mr. Brayman's brief foray with Mr. Allen regarding the coaching and the letters, and none of the rest of us were allowed to go into it. Mr. Brayman was not Mr. Banks' lawyer, and he was not the lawyer for the other defendants. But even if we assume that, the extent to which he was allowed to go into it limited the cross-examination to such an extent that we weren't able to challenge the credibility. Another point. Tillman, while he was at the MCC, attempted to escape. We weren't allowed to go into it. Nothing could tell more about the government. What we're talking about here is the witnesses' perceptions of the government's power over them and the extent to which that they would go to please the government. We weren't allowed to bring out about the fact that he was in solitary confinement, and the judge said that because the escape allegation had not been decided, that we shouldn't be able to question about it. But that was the point. The government had
in Allen's letters, did he say that he was willing to coach witnesses?
No, he did not.
I thought that's what you said.
No. I was saying that he said how far he would go.
Didn't he say he told the FBI he would coach?
He told the FBI, yes.
But not in the letters.
Not in the letters. No, not in the letters, Judge. If you thought I said that, you either I was wrong or you were wrong. I didn't mean to say it. What it does say is it tells us...
These letters, this is sentimental stuff.
It's not sentimental in my view, Judge. But actually, I'll let the jury decide it.
Well,
that's the point.
It's about coaching that he said to the FBI. Was that told to the jury?
No. Just in the little bitty... Did you say, sir, that you coached?
Right,
Magister?
Right.
Yeah.
That seems to me you got before the jury what was damaging.
No. How many witnesses did he coach? What did he tell them? How much did he tell them? What about did you say to him about amounts of cocaine?
Yeah,
what about times that meetings took place?
I don't get the connection between that and the letters.
The letters
say you weren't allowed to explore the coaching issue?
We were not.
Is that one of your grounds of appeal?
Yes.
I didn't notice that.
I believe that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinesh. Ms. Knopf.
May it please the court, counsel. While admittedly rare, this case concerning Rabboni Smith possesses a unique combination of factors that I submit ought to compel this court to intervene. The critical question here concerning Mr. Smith is whether this court has the confidence in the reliability of the jury verdict given the enormity of the errors below, both singularly and collectively. The court below allowed the jury to hear evidence they ought not to have heard and prevented the jury from hearing evidence they ought to have heard. Also, after trial, upon discovery of new evidence that corroborated Mr. Smith's coercion claims, the court summarily dismissed all attempts to explore those issues. The end result was that Mr. Smith was denied a fair trial. As you're aware, I filed an extensive brief and reply brief, and there's a multitude of errors by the court and acts of misconduct by the prosecution that I cite. Because of my time limitations, I'd like to focus on a few areas that I think were the most egregious and were harmful errors. The first was the admission of the MCC tape. The court below allowed the government to ambush defendant with inadmissible extrinsic evidence that was so damning it changed the course of the trial at the very moment it was heard. And the court further exacerbated that by allowing the government to argue the significance of that inadmissible evidence to the jury. I submit to this court that upon examination of that evidence, that there is no conceivable ground for admission. The government poses a far-fetched argument that this evidence came in pursuant to Rule 613, prior inconsistent statements. Impossible. First, there was no foundation laid for the statement. And second, it has to be at odds with what was in the testimony at trial. The tape, Your Honors, is in evidence, and I would ask you to listen to it, but what it was a tape-recorded phone call between Mr. Smith and his employer. He worked at the Illinois Department of Transportation as an engineer. After he was arrested, while he was in the MCC, waiting to bond out. And in there, during that conversation, he tells his boss about a relative that's murdered and that the children are going to go to DCFS and he can't be at work. There was never a question asked of Mr. Smith that's required for a prior inconsistent statement. By the way, if it was admissible at all, and it wasn't. But you would have to ask Mr. Smith, isn't it true that you told your boss on such and such a date that you had a relative that was murdered and that you couldn't come to work? That's how you lay a foundation for prior inconsistent statement. Nothing like that happened. What did happen? They open up their cross-examination with, you tell stories to get out of a jam, don't you? I don't understand the question, basically, is what my client said. And it goes on and on.
Would it be a shock to you that most people do? Go ahead. Go ahead, sorry.
No, that's okay. And it continues on and on and on. And then, when my client really says, you know, I don't know what you're talking about, what happens? The government has the audacity to say, let me refresh your recollection. Refresh it about what? And I object. And may I be heard, Judge? No. Basically, sit down. And that tape is played. And I submit that that so tainted the trial, it was impossible from that point on to get a fair trial. And specifically what happened was, it's not like they played that tape and then they let it go. The government, launched that evidence, their entire case from that evidence. And let me tell you that even
How did they do that? Let's assume error.
Okay.
How did it launch their case against them?
I'd say a large portion of the rebuttal argument particularly, and some of the closing argument, talks about this lie, and I've quoted a lot of it, particularly this is what's said in rebuttal. Smith's in a jam. He tells a story. And isn't it strikingly similar to the same lie he told his boss? It was a story he told out to get out of a jam, just like the story he told you. It never ends. His boss, he lied to his boss. And it not only wasn't a prior inconsistent statement, it was inadmissible because it's collateral. How could that evidence independently come into a trial? It couldn't. And the government has been unable to support their theory. So I submit to you that this is just not an error that we can whitewash.
Call harmless.
Yeah, or call harmless.
That's the term of art we usually use.
Yes. Whitewash just came to my mind.
I understand.
And the government was very dependent on that lie, very dependent. And not only did the government introduce inadmissible extrinsic evidence, they ambushed me, the defense. They violated the rules of evidence. Rule 16 requires statements of defendants to be produced. I didn't get it. And what else did they violate? Judge Castillo ordered that all 608B or 404B evidence be turned over 2 weeks prior to trial. And the government tries to weasel out of this one and say that it's not a 608B. It was a question that was attacking my client's truthfulness or lack thereof. Of course, you can't prove that up with extrinsic evidence either. The evidence was irrelevant. It should have never come in. The government admitted in its brief and to the court that it was irrelevant. The judge said it was collateral.
Is that all you have to say for Smith?
No, I have a lot more to say. So I suggested that the jury heard evidence that they should have, should not have. The jury didn't hear evidence that they... that would have confirmed critical aspects of Smith's account. Mr. Smith was denied an expert. Pre-trial, we moved for an expert.
I don't understand what an expert adds in a case like this. Is he an expert on the Black Disciples or just on gangs in general?
Dr. Hagedorn is known nationally, and he is an expert on African-American gangs in Chicago, including the Black Disciples and
other
gangs.
Well, then is he testifying as an expert or as a fact witness?
He would have been a framework, he would have given framework testimony.
I don't know what that means.
Well, it's very similar to the experts that are used in most of the government's cases that are condoned by this court.
So he was testifying as an expert witness?
Yes, sir.
That was the question.
Oh, yes.
But an expert testifies about something that the jury needs help with. So if the police officers testify about, you know, what the meaning of words used as code, of course that's something the jurors don't know, so the expert is helpful. But how is an expert helpful
in testifying about what is obvious, and as well as brought out by a number of the fact witnesses, which is that, yes, of course, if you owe money to a gang, you don't pay them, you're likely to be beaten up or worse. Everyone knows that. Since the gang can't use the legal machinery to enforce its debts, it uses strong-arm tactics. Everyone knows that. So what would the expert add?
Well, I think the expert would have given a global understanding of
the what do you need a global understanding if you have the local understanding? We know that the witnesses said, the black disciples, they're tough guys. If you owe them money, you don't pay them, you're in trouble. Everyone knows that. And
well, in U.S. versus
did the government say, no, the black disciples are sweeties?
No.
If you don't pay them, they just pray for you.
No, but the government, this is a very good point, Judge, because the government did say this. As much as there was piecemeal evidence that came out about gangs being violent and this happening and that happening, the government, instead of agreeing with that to an extent, they mocked and minimized it, contemptuously portraying Mr. Smith's defense as nothing but falsehoods grounded in stereotypes. So they use those things that you're speaking of and call them stereotypes.
What would the purported expert have testified to other than stereotypes?
The expert would have testified as to his studies. He actually conducted studies about gangs.
I understand, but he's discussing in the final analysis a stereotype. That is, a gang member, particularly one from that gang, is violent, prone to beat people up, owe money, and that sort of thing, a stereotypical discussion of what the disciples are.
Would he give
specific instances that he was aware of, that he saw and witnessed and knew about?
I don't think that he personally witnessed, but he would talk about...
Well, then he was talking about stereotypes.
Not exactly. Stereotypes mean that it's not always... through it's a generalization.
Yeah.
I think he would have talked about the military-like hierarchy in the Black Disciples.
Oh,
he would have talked about that it's not random violence, that if you don't pay your debt, what happens is it's planned. They kidnapped him. They kidnapped him off the campus. They beat him. They required him to do certain things, that they don't forgive dates. So it wouldn't have been stereotypes. But I see my time, the red light's on. But I just want to say that...
if your red light's on, you can't say anything.
Oh. Can I say one sentence?
Yeah, you may.
Ask him.
What I want to say is that it came out piecemeal, but you'll see in the briefs, and I've quoted it, they actually likened Mr. Smith's situation, and I quote, for a TV, made-for-TV movie, mocking it, kidnapping at gunpoint, ha, 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 torture, threats to family, strange men in houses, surveillance. Yep. That's why we needed the expert.
There was a proffer made on this expert.
There was a proffer in writing. There was a reconsideration motion. And we were denied access for funds to even...
That's okay. You didn't have to spend the money because they didn't let him testify, so you were saved there.
Thank you, Ms. Knopp. Mr. Brayman.
Good morning. My name is Paul Brayman, and I represent John Ector, and I'm here to argue the sentencing aspects of this case as they apply to Mr. Ector and some of the co-defendants. I guess I'd like to start with the first sentencing in this case, and that was Keith McGee on June 6th of 2001. At that point, and throughout really the sentencing in this case, Judge Castillo had indicated to the various parties how complicated a case this was, how the conspiracy lasted years, how there were vast amounts of drugs and money.
What are you complaining about, Ector, before you get it, rather than into McGee? What is it about Ector's sentence that bothers you?
Well, it's to all the defendants, Your Honor.
I thought you were just representing Ector.
I am, but we have...
So what's your complaint about his sentence?
About what sentence?
Ector's sentence.
That the fact that the drug quantities that were arrived by the district court were clearly erroneous.
Is he the 2 kilograms or the 1.5 kilograms?
All of them. There was no basis.
No, Exner, well, what was the quantity?
Okay, the 1.5 kilograms.
He's the 1.5.
Yes, okay. Of crack cocaine.
Right.
There's absolutely no evidence in the record to indicate that John Ecker had any dealings with a smidgen of crack cocaine. The reason I mentioned Mr. McGee's sentencing, which preceded Mr. Ecker's and was the first sentence, was because Judge Castillo employed a test of Allen Plus.
Right.
He said that he couldn't rely on Allen's testimony because the conspiracy was so vast and it wasn't reliable, Allen's recollection. So in McGee's case, the government argued and pointed out to Judge Castillo that Allen had testified that Mr. McGee was involved in 4 kilograms of powder and 2 kilograms of crack cocaine. Judge Castillo said, wait a minute, I'm not going to buy that. I'm just going to deal with the amounts of cocaine that were actually shown to be associated with Mr. McGee, and therefore I'm not going to impose at level 38. I'm going to impose a lesser level for Mr. McGee, even though I'm not going to give him a minor role. And the reason this becomes so ludicrous is because when Mr. Ector is sentenced, and there's not a smidgen of evidence that he had anything to do with crack cocaine, the judge at that point talks about Allen and how complicated the case was, and yet when it comes to Mr. Ector, who I submit...
Was Ector the one who asked for type, or was that someone else?
It was Mr. Ector that asked for a specific
type.
Jury finding?
No, type. Did he use the word type to describe the...
No, that wasn't Mr. Ector.
That wasn't, okay.
No. So when it comes to Mr. Ector, you have the fact that there's no evidence of any crack cocaine, and yet at the time that Mr. Ector, 6 months later in November, Judge Castillo says, well, I guess I'm not going to play it. He talked about the Allen Plus test, but then he says, well, there's a mosaic in this case, I think is the term he used, so I'm going to give Mr. Ector all the cocaine I can, the 1.5 kilos of crack and the powder cocaine, the 8 kilograms of powder cocaine. And I submit the evidence that in this case shows that Mr. Ector, from the evidence you heard at trial, shouldn't be accountable for any more than one and a half kilos to 2 kilos of powder cocaine, and that would have left him at level 26. The government argued that it was 8, and this is another thing that's ironic. They argue at the sentencing of Mr. Ector that he should be responsible for all the cocaine in the whole conspiracy, even though that is a test that Judge Castillo had rejected in sentencing Mr. McGee. But then they say in the alternative, we know that he dealt with 8 kilograms of powder cocaine. So Judge Castillo decides to put the full burden of all the cocaine in the conspiracy that the government was urging kind of generally on Mr. Ector. But then what happens, I think, to put this in perspective, is the next day when
What did the Judge Castillo mean when he said that he was basing Ector's sentence not only in Allen's testimony but on Ector's own words?
You've got me, because there were no words that came out in the trial to show that Ector had anything to do with any crack cocaine. And what shows that more than anything is the next day Mr. Brim is sentenced. One day later, Mr. Brim comes before the court for sentencing, and Judge Castillo says, Ms. Salivar, tell me how you view Mr. Brim in relationship to Mr. Ector. Ms. Salivar says, Mr. Brim is more involved, because Ector was only involved in 8 kilograms of powder cocaine, while Mr. Brim was involved in crack cocaine and powder cocaine over a longer period of time. The government's own admission is that Ector's only involved in 8 kilograms of powder cocaine. So to give him any crack cocaine in determining the amount of drugs that he's responsible for on a foreseeability basis, there's just no evidence of it at all. And that goes for all the other defendants that he ended up at a level 38. Mr. Brim, the McGees, Mr. King, there's absolutely no basis for that. We certainly preserve this issue by asking the judge for a jury instruction as to the specific amount that each defendant was individually responsible for. Under a foreseeability standard, So there was, the judge rejected that verdict form, and there was a general verdict form that the jury found that the conspiracy itself involved 50 grams of crack and 5 kilograms of powder cocaine. I would submit that based on that verdict, the jury hasn't even found for any one given defendant an amount that even triggers the statutory mandatory minimum in this case. And I think we have argued, of course, Blakely and Booker, and I don't want to go over that because I know that you've heard those arguments.
At a higher pay grade.
Yes?
At a higher pay grade.
Yeah. So I am just asking that based on the arbitrariness of sentencing the individual defendants in this case and the abuse of discretion that the trial court employed in this case, that all the defendant sentences should be vacated, in this case should be remanded for resentencing. Thank you,
Mr. Freeman. Ms. Brown.
This morning I'd first like to address the issues that were raised by defense counsel in oral argument this morning, and secondly, if there's time available, I'd like to turn to the government's cross-appeal with respect to Ector and Flozell McGee. With respect to the argument that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's motion to disclose the 3500 materials, and specifically the PSRs, the context surrounding that motion is that the defendants made a motion to disclose the PSRs of cooperating witnesses. And in line with Seventh Circuit case law, Judge Castillo conducted an in-camera review of those PSRs. And after conducting that in-camera review, released the financial section of Mr. Allen's PSR, finding that it was Brady material. And in so doing, Judge Castillo met the test that the Seventh Circuit has set out that says you have to weigh the confidentiality of the PSRs against the government's obligation to disclose Brady and Giglio materials. As to the issue of whether or not a PSR is a statement under Section 3500, it's a separate issue as to whether or not the trial court met its obligation to conduct that in-camera review and release the pertinent parts of the PSR.
There's no question it was a statement made by a witness, is it?
The government would contend that it is not a statement adopted by a witness because an adoption of a PSR report by a defendant is very different.
We're talking about statements made in producing a PSR report. That's what they're looking for, is it?
The defense counsel were looking for statements that were made
by the witness.
By the witnesses to the probation department.
Right.
And
which would demonstrate an interest, bias, or prejudice.
Yes, and the trial court reviewed those PSRs that would be for Brady material and for Giglio material and disclosed all pertinent material under that review as set forth by the Seventh Circuit. The Fifth Circuit and the Third Circuit, however, have set forth that PSRs are not statements of defendants, and that's for two reasons. First of all,
witnesses, you mean?
Excuse me?
Witnesses.
Of witnesses. And they're not statements by witnesses, first of all, because the probation department is the party that obtains the statement, not the government. And
you mean the probation department doesn't work for the government?
And in this case, the government disclosed the PSRs to the court upon the defendant's motion.
Well, they don't want them to go to the court. They want to go to the court. They want to see them. That's what 3500 doesn't say. You show it to the court, says you show it to the defendant.
The Seventh Circuit has addressed this issue in part by discussing the need to keep PSRs confidential and the way to weigh the confidentiality of the PSRs and also balance it with the need to disclose the Brady and Giglio materials is to do what Judge Castillo did in this case, which is to conduct an in-camera review of those materials and then release
them. So we have to do the same thing he did.
You don't have to go back and
I just have to take his word for it?
Yes, in this case, Judge Castillo did not abuse his discretion.
How do I know until I read
it? because this was a three-week trial that extended in pretrial.
I got a lot of time. I've been here almost 30 years. I got a couple of weeks to go.
I'm sorry.
Is it necessary or appropriate for us to read the material that is being that Castile read?
Your Honor, with all due deference, I don't believe it is necessary to read the materials.
Do you have any support for that as a matter of law?
Well, if we don't look at them, we don't get. Then there's no appellate review. I don't understand your position.
To look at the, you can look at the statements in order to determine whether or not Judge Castillo abused his discretion.
That was my question.
I apologize.
We worked our way around that.
Yeah, I apologize. but as the Third Circuit and Fifth Circuit held, those circuits have held that PSRs are not statements of.
They're not 3,500 material, is that what they said?
That they are not 3,500 material. That's correct. And so the government would urge the circuit to continue along with its prior holdings that the manner in which Judge Castillo evaluated the defendant's motion was in fact the right way to handle that motion and did not abuse his discretion by conducting that in-camera review and then releasing only the pertinent parts of those reports to defense counsel. I'd next like to turn to the argument that the trial court violated the rights of the defendants to confront the witnesses against them by limiting the cross-examination of Allen regarding his letters to the AUSA. There were two letters in this case that Allen wrote to the AUSA, and first of all, as the government set forth in a brief, these letters are hearsay because the manner in which questions were asked about the contents of this letter sought the truth of the matter asserted. But secondly,
the letters were hearsay. Written?
The manner in which the defense counsel asked questions regarding the letters, the government argued at trial, was hearsay. But over the government's objection, the trial court permitted extensive questioning regarding the letter.
Letters go into evidence?
They didn't go into evidence, but as the trial court noted and as the government notes in the footnote on page 37 of its brief, the first letter was almost entirely read into evidence, as was the second letter.
Allen testified. Aren't these statements of his used to impeach him?
He was asked, you
what
said...
What did hearsay have to do with that?
He was asked, you said X, Y, and Z in the letter, instead of saying, at this time... You felt like you wanted to do everything you could to help the government out, and that was elicited from Mr. Allen on cross-examination. And regardless of the hearsay issue, because the government's objections were overruled repeatedly, Judge Castillo let the question.
I don't understand why you made a hearsay objection.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
I don't understand why you made a hearsay objection to using a witness's statement to impeach him.
What aspect of it was hearsay?
It was the manner in which the question was
asked. No,
it can't
be a matter. The contents of the letter either are or are not hearsay, and what do you think they are?
The government argued at trial.
No, I'm asking you now, what do you think they are? Do you think they are hearsay, the letters?
The letters are not hearsay. The manner in which the questions were asked.
You can make something hearsay by the way you asked the question.
Yes, it called for hearsay. It called for the truth of the matter asserted in the letters.
I was more struck by Mr. Nash's comment that he wasn't allowed to explore this question whether Allen had offered to coach witnesses. I didn't see that in your brief.
I
missed it.
It was addressed in the brief, Your Honor. In fact, impeachment of Allen with respect to that question was perfected. He was asked if he coached Irving Kelman to provide certain answers. He said yes, then he said no, then he said yes, and then he said no again. So he provided inconsistent statements, and in that sense, the government would concede he revealed that perhaps on that matter
but,
he
but
was
Mr.
not.
But Mr. Nash said that the judge cut him off. He gave the impression that he was just allowed to ask one question.
Your Honor, with all due deference, upon review of the record, the government did not find this the kind of extensive questioning that Mr. Nash suggests was there.
He didn't say there. He said he couldn't ask. He was precluded from asking.
The question that was sustained as asked and answered was the question regarding whether or not Allen coached Tillman with respect just generally. That question was asked and answered, and Judge Castillo sustained the government's objection that it was asked and answered. Judge Castillo made no rulings, and the government made no objections regarding any of
this. There was no further attempt to inquire as to who he coached or when he coached him or anything else.
Based on the government's review of the record, I don't believe that there was.
Perhaps I'm not tracking this correctly, but I thought Mr. Nash's point is that one defense counsel made an inquiry in this area, and that you're reflecting that exchange, and that subsequent counsel were precluded from making an entry into that area.
After they asked and received, I believe, the same answer, and then the objection was made, asked and answered, Judge Castillo sustained the objection. But again, Your Honor, I believe a review of the record would show that these additional questions about other coaching of other witnesses, of how many witnesses, how many times he tried to coach witnesses, that was not asked.
So a fair reading of the record, as you would suggest it is that in this multi-defendant, multi-counsel case, that we don't have a situation where the district judge made a determination that an initial counsel examination covered the waterfront, and therefore subsequent counsel need not go into it? Is that what happened?
Could not go into it.
Or could not go into it, yeah.
The government's reading is not like that whatsoever. The government's reading of the record is that Judge Castillo simply limited defense counsel's questioning on this particular question, the coaching of Mr. Tillman by Mr. Allen. And by the government's review of the record, I don't believe that they tried to ask additional questions. More importantly, and put in the more broader context of this trial, Mr. Allen was cross-examined extensively regarding his bias. He was cross-examined extensively regarding his credibility. And as a result of the trial court's permissive rulings in this regard, the trial court gave the defendants more than a reasonable chance to discredit the witnesses against them, and as a result, the cross-examination of the defendants elicited information that allowed the jury to assess the credibility of the witnesses. One final evidentiary ruling that Mr. Nash mentioned was the bad act of Mr. Tillman having escaped from the MCC, and the trial court's ruling barring questioning regarding that incident was perfectly in line with the federal rules of evidence. First of all, it was solely an arrest, not a conviction. And secondly, he ruled under 403 that the probative value of that evidence was substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect. And in that regard, Judge Castillo's evidentiary rulings that Mr. Nash brought up on behalf of the defendants should be affirmed because they were not an abuse of Judge Castillo's discretion. I'd like to turn now to the arguments made on behalf of Mr. Smith, and first of all, the argument regarding the playing of the MCC tape. I'd like to put the playing of the MCC tape in context.
Before you go on away, I'm looking at page 40 of your brief.
Yes.
And what you say is, the counsel for Ector and Banks subsequently asked Allen again whether he admitted. Now we've got Allen saying, yes, he did, no, he didn't, yes, he did. And they ask whether he had coached Maverick Tillman. And they say that the question was asked and answered. Do you think that the question has been asked and answered, but it's been asked and answered three different ways, as near as I could tell?
And in that sense, it's been the impeachment has been perfected.
Wouldn't you think that they'd have an opportunity to explore further what he asked him, what he coached him, if he would admit now again that he did?
Based on the briefs that were filed by defense counsel and based on the review of the record, that was the last question, I believe, that was asked in open court regarding whether or not Allen had coached Maverick Tillman.
Well, yeah, but in a, to suggest that it was repetitive cross-examination isn't deadly accurate. He has not given a square answer to anybody. He said yes, no, yes, no. And now he's precluded from going any further.
They were precluded from going any further with respect to the question of did you coach Maverick Tillman? That had been asked and answered.
Well, but it had been asked and answered, but not the same way each time. Yes, no, yes, no.
At that point in time, there...
Don't you shut it off? We can't explore any further? We can't say, well...
With respect to that question, the kinds of questions that Mr. Nash was mentioning that defense counsel was interested in asking Mr. Allen were not subject to that ruling. The questions that he was mentioning were, how many people had you coached?
Did
how many
he
occasions?
Try to ask those questions?
Based on the briefs that were filed by defense counsel and review of the record, it doesn't seem as if they were.
Okay.
So turning now to the MCC tape, I'd like to put in the playing of the tape in context of the trial. And this was a three-week trial in which the defendants had an opportunity to assess and the jury had the opportunity to assess the credibility of the government witnesses as well as the credibility of the defense witnesses and the defendants in some instances. And in this case,
We'll address the issue of admissibility.
At the time that the tape was played, the objection was, I have not heard this, I have not received this. And the court permitted the government to play the tape over that objection. It is the government's position that at that time, the tape was admissible under Rule 613 as a prior inconsistent statement of the witness. The statement that Smith provided on the stand was that he never made stories regarding his situation in this case to get out of a jam. He denied that statement. The prior inconsistent statement was that he had, in fact, made up a story about his situation in this case to get out of a jam. And that story was contained on the tape. It was a story to his employer, who, when Mr. Smith told that employer that he was in Kansas, not in the MCC, that he was there to pick up a relative, a child of the murdered relative.
Well, it had nothing to do with the case, did it? It was totally immaterial to the case.
It was material to his credibility.
You're not following me.
It wasn't material to the case, no.
Okay. If he had said on the stand that he was 26 years old, and as a matter of fact he was 29, would that be material to the case? Could you use that?
Yes, you could.
You could. Well, at least you're consistent in your position. Why should you?
Yeah, I don't think you're giving the right answer. I think what... I thought his statement that he gave on the stand was relevant to the case, right? His statement on the stand is, or the question was, did you make up something about this case? Not are you what your age is? Because if it was an immaterial question, then you can't use extrinsic evidence to
Your Honor,
him.
You're right, and I apologize for that. The distinction I'm trying to draw is that it's not material to the case in the sense that it's discoverable under Rule 16, because it's not material to the indictment. It is material to the case that he is telling stories in this case to get out of a jam.
The case is immaterial. The question whether he's telling stories is material.
Right.
And the tape undermines his answer to the material question. But that was your position.
Exactly, and it's illustrative of the larger lie, the important lie in this case that he told, which was his coercion defense. He presented a defense in which he said, as a college-educated man, he was kidnapped from the college campus, that he was beaten, and beaten notably by a person that the government produced evidence on was not present at the beating. He was actually in custody in the Illinois Department of Corrections, that he was then forced to sell drugs over the next 6 months, and never told law enforcement. And what the government's evidence was and what the government's cross-examination showed was that, in fact, this was a man, based on his own statements and the tape-recorded conversations, that he willingly and voluntarily sold drugs, that even after being arrested, after being Mirandized, and after providing a statement, he didn't say one word about this coercion defense. And Therefore, the questions about the MCC tape, about that conversation he had with his employer, was illustrative of the larger lie, the lie that the jury used to expose his coercion defense for what it was,
the larger
which was
lie,
false.
The larger lie being, Ms. Brown, that he'd lie about anything?
That he lied about his coercion defense.
So the government, if Mr. Smith had called his wife, or had a conversation with his wife, and had said, I just talked to my mother and told her I won't. It's Thanksgiving. We won't make it because I have to be in Kansas. Because he doesn't want to tell his mother he's at the MCC. Would that qualify probably as something you would have used in this case? Is that the equivalent of this?
Well, having not been on the trial team, Your Honor,
you can't
I don't know if that's
personal
level.
But I, what I'm suggesting
you
want to
kick grandmothers around here, you know.
I'm suggesting even a little white lie. Would fit into this predicate that he'll lie about anything.
It is indicative and illustrative of the lie he told, and that's not the lie he told in this case.
No,
it wasn't a little white lie.
I understand. But not wanting your employer to know that you're in jail, I assume for the purposes of, I guess we can assume for holding the job, if it's to be there, you suggest is the equivalent of making up a story about kidnapping.
And in this case, he had a choice to tell a little white lie.
You're wandering way off. Because now you're making it sound as if, and following up with Chief Judge Farmer saying, it sounded as if even if they hadn't asked him any questions, you could have put the tape on, you could have played the tape to show he's a liar. I mean, you have this notion of illustrative, you know, illustrative lies. I wouldn't go down that road if I were you.
And, Your Honor, the government does not contend that we could have played the tape regardless of whether or not he even testified. It is a prior and consistent statement under Rule 613, and the government had the opportunity to play the tape after he provided a statement, and the government had extrinsic evidence that that statement was in fact false.
Is it after he's given a testimony that he's been kidnapped and coerced and otherwise abused fearfully?
Yes.
But doesn't 16 speak to irreconcilable statements, one at trial and one out of trial? Isn't that the basis of 613?
The basis of 613 is to give the parties an opportunity such as this, where there is a lie that is material to the case so that the government can expose that lie.
What is irreconcilable about the two, quote, lies, other than they're both, you know, the government's used lies? Are all lies, therefore, each lie one makes is irreconcilable with every other lie that you tell in life?
Well, as Smith's counsel pointed out, the government in its closing said this lie was a made-for-TV movie lie. It was over the top. And as Your Honor said, is a white lie the same thing as the lie that Mr. Smith told? And I would argue it's not, because he had the opportunity to tell a white lie when he called his employer and said, I'm not going to be in. And instead, he told a completely over-the-top lie. He told a lie that's indicative of the lie that he told in this case in order to get out of the charges.
Yeah, but you're coming close to saying that the government can ask someone, are you a liar? And if he says no, then it can parade all his previous lies and prove them by extrinsic evidence. That doesn't sound right.
And in this case, the specific statement that the defendant made wasn't that I don't lie. It was that he never told a story in this case to get out of a jam, which wasn't true.
You have a narrow argument, and you keep trying to broaden it.
Now, it's connected to the case because he's in the MCC. Is that the connection?
Because it's the circumstances under which he's in the MCC. Yes, it's for this case. But as to the arguments that Ms. Counsel...
No, I don't think his play being in the MCC has anything to do with it. I thought your argument was that he was asked specifically whether he'd made up anything about this case. It's the government's argument that he fabricated all this coercion stuff. And he said, no, he hasn't made up anything about this case. And then you show he did make up something about the case, not about his criminality. I mean, not about, not directly relevant, but the story or the conversation on the tape was about the case. It doesn't matter where he was when he had the conversation. He just, you know,
thing
to out on bail, it would be the same.
The thing to do is adopt his position completely and then let it go. Mm-hmm.
You're right, Your Honor. It's the fact that he is, and what I'm attempting to do is just give the context surrounding why he is there and why he's making the call.
Both you and Ms. Dunn are spending much too much time on this issue. There's a zillion other issues. Could I ask you about, in case time runs out, one of the issues didn't come up at the argument, but which is a curious thing, is this voice identification issue. So, as I understand it, it does involve Smith. So, the government played a Smith tape to his neighbors. So apparently the neighbors liked him because, what, they bought his house? They bought his house for $37,000. They liked him. And the government says, in effect, you shouldn't like this guy. Just listen to this. So the question is whether this is a violation of the wiretap law. Now, this wasn't played at the trial, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, just a... So what I don't understand the voice identification defense that the government has raised to this disclosure of the wiretap. I don't get that.
Your Honor, the circumstances surrounding this particular incident was that it was 2 weeks before trial. The government wasn't aware of what Smith's defense would be and wasn't aware of who he would call as witnesses in support of his defense. Mr. Gunn and Ms. Precious had sold their home to the wife of Mr. Smith for under market value. No other circumstances were known about the circumstance about that sale of property, other than the fact that it was in turn used to post bond for Mr. Smith. So 2 weeks prior to trial, trying to develop witnesses, not only government witnesses, but also defense witnesses, which is envisioned by the wiretap statute and also by the legislative history, is that the agents went to the house, and only after Mr. Gum and Ms. Precious stated that they could not believe that Mr. Smith could be involved in such conduct, they disputed the identity of Mr. Smith in the charged conduct. And at that point, the agents played the tape in order so that they could identify that Smith was on those tapes and that Smith...
But as I understand, they hadn't gone to these people's house in order to find out whether the voice on the tape was Smith.
Well,
the voice identification, this is an after-the-fact rationalization. It's not the actual purpose of playing the tape to the neighbors. And isn't that a problem for you?
The government contends that because the tapes were played to witnesses that the agents were attempting to develop in anticipation of trial, and because those witnesses, in essence, denied the identity of Mr. Smith, they were permitted under the statute.
But their purpose was not to verify that it was Smith's voice. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to convince these people that they had estimated Smith's character incorrectly. And maybe that's a lawful purpose, but I don't think the voice identification was the purpose.
It was the government's position at trial, and it remains the government's position that was the purpose that the agents played the tape for. However, the statutory scheme and the legislative history doesn't define development of witnesses solely as using tapes to identify voices in a trial. And as Judge Castillo noted, the playing of these tapes didn't constitute a trial error. It didn't constitute an error of prejudice.
Spoiled. Did these neighbors testify?
No, they didn't.
Well, but weren't they? They would have if the tape hadn't been played to them. And maybe that's the proper, you know, scare. maybe that's what developing witnesses means, but as I say, it seems the obvious purpose of playing the tape was not voice identification, but to give the neighbors a more realistic picture of Smith's character.
In any event, even if the trial court erred, it didn't err clearly, because the motion in this case wasn't about those two tapes. It was to suppress all 4,000 intercepted calls, which was not the inappropriate action, which was not the appropriate action to take in this case. And as such, the trial court didn't clearly err by ordering those 4,000 intercepted calls to be suppressed. And
that clearly is the stronger argument.
Turning to back to Ms. Domp's last argument regarding the appointment of the expert witness, I would just direct the panel's attention.
What is this man's field, Dr. Hagerburn?
It is the government's understanding that he is an expert in African American street gangs.
No, but I mean, it must be a field: political science, sociology, criminology.
If I recall reading the defense briefs correctly, he may be based in sociology, but I don't recall. But as the trial court noted, in this case, Judge Castillo said, quote, it was to call Dr. Hagedorn, was, quote, unnecessary because it's pretty much common knowledge that drug activity can be dangerous. And the motion to appoint Dr. Hagedorn was not only denied once, it was denied twice, pre-trial, and then it was denied after the government had put on its case, and I believe towards the tail end of the defense case, when the government witnesses and the defense witnesses were in virtual agreement about the structure of the Black Disciples gang, that it is a dangerous entity, and that its members can do great harm to gang members and non-gang members alike if you cross the gang in any number of ways, including owing money. And so with respect to that evidentiary ruling of the trial court, it certainly was not an abuse of discretion on the part of Judge Castillo to deny that motion. I'd like to turn now to the arguments regarding sentencing and drug quantities. As appellant counsel pointed out, Judge Castillo employed what he called the Allen Plus test. And contrary to what the defense counsel said, with respect to Ector, he didn't say, I'm finding based on no standard that Ector is responsible for 8 kilograms of powder cocaine and 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. He said that he made that finding beyond a reasonable doubt, and he made that finding based on his voice on the tapes. Ector's voice on the tapes with respect to crack cocaine, in which he referred to picking up a quote-unquote four-piece spicy, and that is the basis that the trial court used to make the finding that he was responsible.
Crack or just cocaine?
It was the agent's testimony as well the testimony of the government witnesses that four-piece spicy was code for crack cocaine. And based on that testimony, Ector's voice on the tapes, and the fact that he bought powder cocaine from his co-conspirators and occasionally acted as a middleman, the trial court found that beyond a reasonable doubt, you could reasonably foresee, or Ector could reasonably foresee, that he was responsible for 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. And the trial court made similar decisions with respect to the other defendants who now appeal the drug quantities that were attributed to them. Both King and Brim were both in the same situation as Ector in the sense that the trial court looked at all of the evidence, applied the Allen Plus test, and found beyond a reasonable doubt that certain drug quantities were attributable to them. Finally, with respect to Ector's argument regarding the specific determination instruction that he requested, consistent with Apprendi, the trial court provided the jury with a verdict form that said if it found the defendant guilty on a conspiracy charge, it had to find the drug type and quantity beyond a reasonable doubt as well. The jury found Ector guilty of the conspiracy, and then on the form they chose the range of 5 kilograms or more of cocaine and 50 kilograms or more, or 50 grams or more of cocaine base. And as the circuit has held in the Smith case, drug quantity is not an element of a conspiracy. The verdict form in this case didn't allow the jury to be anything but unanimous, and that's what they were. Secondly, the jury didn't need to decide on the precise amount of drugs as opposed to a range, which is what they found. They didn't even have to agree on a particular means of committing the offense so long as they agreed on the elements, which is what they did in this case. If the panel doesn't have any further questions about the direct appeal, I'd like to now move to the government's cross appeal. The sentencing guidelines make clear that the acceptance of responsibility adjustment is not generally available for defendants who proceed to trial. And instead, there is only a limited exception that the adjustment is available in rare circumstances where the defendant proceeds to trial. And that's in situations where, first, the defendant admits all factual elements of his guilt, and secondly, he accepts responsibility in his pretrial statements and in his pretrial conduct. And in this case, neither defendant Ector nor defendant Flozell McGee contested the account of the facts that the government provided in its brief. And as such, we should look at the facts, because the facts prove that they didn't admit all the factual elements of their guilt. They contested both their involvement in the conspiracy as a whole, as well as their involvement with certain quantities of drugs. Throughout trial, they questioned the veracity of government witnesses. Secondly, the facts prove that neither defendant accepted responsibility in their pretrial conduct and statements. And to the contrary, Flozell McGee provided a false proffer to the government, which is absolutely the opposite of accepting your responsibility in pretrial statements and conduct. And Judge Castillo acknowledged as much by saying during Ector's sentencing hearing that he evaluated Ector's acceptance of responsibility at the time of sentencing, and at Flozell McGee's sentencing hearing that he evaluated acceptance of responsibility at the time of trial and the time of sentencing. So under the sentencing guidelines and under this circuit's case law, it is very clear that in this case, the trial court clearly erred in awarding the acceptance of responsibility adjustments to Flozell McGee and to Ector. If the panel doesn't have any further questions, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the convictions and sentences of defendants Brim, Ector, Banks, Keith McGee, Flozell McGee, McKenzie, King, and Smith, and that this court also reversed the trial court's rulings awarding Ector and Flozell McGee an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Nash.
Brief. We did not ask for PSR reports. This is not a Brady issue. It's not a Giglio issue. It is an issue of 3500 plain and simple. These statements were not statements made to the probation department in the sense that 3500 says a written statement made by a witness. It doesn't limit it to probation department, to the government, to the court.
But if it's not Brady or Giglio material, what good would it be for you? And what's the harm?
I didn't see it, Judge.
No, I understand. But if you accepted that there was no Brady or Giglio material in it...
Jinx and all the cases...
I know, but what's the harm? If it's not impeaching and it's not exculpatory, what good would it do you?
With due respect to Judge Castillo and to your honors, the person to make that judgment is defense counsel. The Congress and the Supreme Court in the Jenks decision have said statements by a witness are to be given to defense counsel. And there is no reason.
Your position, Mr. Nash, is that it doesn't make any difference what he said. It's still available to you. The government has no right to keep it from you.
Exactly.
I got it.
Now, this is yet to be established in any circuit, though, right, Mr. Nash?
Actually, in the district court level, the point is that most judges look at the question, is it a statement of the witness? And they give it to you. For some reason, this issue, as many of the cases that have gone to review to appellate courts, they address it as Giglio and Brady and decide it much like Judge Posner's question indicated, that, well, the judge looked at it, he decided it wasn't, and therefore it doesn't have to be turned over. But it's a 3500 question. It's not a question of that.
Are you suggesting it is routinely turned over in district court?
It has been turned over because they turn over the statements of the witness.
But including the PSRs?
We don't want the PSR. Most of the PSR we're not entitled to. We're asking for that portion of the PSR. That's a statement of the witness.
Are you saying district judges are giving you that?
Yes. Statements of the witness.
No, but are they taking it out of the PSR and giving it to you?
I've seen it on several occasions. The next question is, with regard to the coaching, Judge Bauer, you got it exactly right. The jury was left with the statement.
But what did you ask that the judge said you couldn't ask? What question did the judge say you couldn't ask?
With regard to the
coaching,
as Judge Bauer pointed out, he said yes, no, yes, no.
You're not answering my question. What question did you try to ask, and the judge said no? That
did you coach Maverick Tillman?
Yes, I know, but that had been asked several times. What else did you ask? Did you seek to ask?
I tried to ask that question. The government objected, said it was asked and answered.
Which it had been.
I told the judge then, or started to say, that he had answered two different ways, and the answer had been left with no. The judge said, stop.
Yes, I know. What would be the point of asking him again? Yes, no, yes, no, 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 yes, yes, yes. What's the point? I thought that you had...
I wanted
the judge, you wanted to ask him not... Yes, no, 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 but you want to ask some follow-up questions.
I did.
Did you ask those
questions? I never got to them.
Did you ask the judge? Did you say to the judge?
Yes.
Would you let me finish?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Did you say to the judge, look, I know he keeps saying yes, no, yes, no. I'd like to probe him. I'd like to ask follow-up questions. Did you say that to the judge?
Transcript page 1282. Yes.
And what did you say at transcript 1, 2, 8?
I started to argue what I wanted to ask, and the judge said no. It's asked and answered. I'm not going to revisit it.
What was the transcript number?
It's page 1282.
So, Mr. Nash, is it your position you tried or you did ask Judge Castillo in such a way to explain to him this is just a gateway question for you to go elsewhere? Well, that's what that transcript will show us. That you explained to him, look, there's more if you'll just let me have another, rather than you showing maybe your ability to cross versus a prior counsel's ability to cross.
My recollection of precisely what occurred is unclear, but what happened is that the judge cut me off and said no. At first he said, asked and answered. I said, it's not asked and answered because the jury was left with the answer, no, I didn't coach him. And I brought it up again in the break. Also page, I misspoke myself, page 1530 also. That was later when I brought it up again. With regard to Your Honor's question about the letters, the point I was making with the coaching is that the fact that he coached other witnesses gave body to his letters as to what he would do. And we weren't allowed to go into it. With the letters, He brought us to a sidebar, the judge did, and said there will be no further questions by any of the other lawyers. That issue is foreclosed. And actually, that carried over to the issue about the coaching. And my point was, how far would he go? He would coach other witnesses. And we weren't allowed to develop that and then to argue that to the jury. And the crucial part of the case being Ellen's credibility, in essence, we weren't able to test that. I know the government thinks we were. I'm sure Judge Castillo thinks that we were. But we weren't. And not providing us with those materials, the witness's statement, and not allowing us to present the letters to the jury because they were hearsay with the witness on the stand, was wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nash. Ms. Dunn.
Dr. Hagedorn was an ethnographer and a criminologist with expertise in American street gangs and the BDs. Page 11 of my brief, and also...
Where is he employed?
University of Illinois last, I believe, when we were going to use him.
University of Illinois what, here or not?
I think here.
Here.
I contacted him here.
And he teaches there?
Yes,
what
and
does
he's
he
also
teach?
In Wisconsin. He lives in Wisconsin also. And he's
what does he teach at the University of Illinois?
Criminology, I believe. And one thing I didn't express about what he would have testified to, which is really important to this case, I think the most puzzling aspect of my defense to the judge was why Mr. Smith didn't go to the police. And Dr. Hagedorn would have been very instrumental in developing that area about the police relationship with gang members. He would have talked about how they can't go to the police. He would have explained it in a very sophisticated fashion, the structure of the police relationship with gangs and how if you rat, you're sure to die. So I think that his testimony was very important. And I just want to bring out that in this court, in 2002, in United States versus Mansouri, this court said, and I quote, the average juror...
These people rat all the time. I don't understand you're saying if you rat, you die. that's the only way the government proves these cases. Turns gang members.
Well, Mr.
They testify, and usually they survive.
Usually they're in protective custody. Sometimes they're separated out. They're in WITSEC. My guy was on the street. And he was already kidnapped and beaten, according to him.
Well, if he could go to the police, or go to the FBI, or go to... U.S. attorney and say, you know, I want to turn state's evidence and I want to be protected.
I believe that Mr. Smith represented to or spoke about how he didn't believe he'd make it that far.
The problem with your coercion defense is it's something that anybody could argue. And when is the last time we sustained a coercion defense?
Well,
ever?
Judge, I don't know, but this one is very much not your garden variety. We had there was documentary evidence of bank records and repayments, but let me bring something to your attention that wasn't brought that maybe just brings this home. What happened post-trial here? It confirmed Mr. Smith's coercion account. Charles Jackson, there's a letter I received from the U.S. attorneys. It's in my brief. Charles Jackson, who's a chief cooperator, in a related case, he says he heard that Mr. Smith was beaten with a baseball bat over a debt. I interviewed Ron...
Wiffle, Matt. Wiffle, not baseball. Wiffle. There's a difference.
Did I say baseball?
You said baseball.
I meant Wiffle. I know Wiffle. Getting a little worked up here, going back to this case. And then I interview a man named Lerone Brim, who's a co-defendant. There's an affidavit in the record that he was approached by Allen to... beat up Mr. Smith about a debt. I mean, we get corroboration after the fact. Then there's another witness that we find out after trial in a related case, a black disciple, that talks about the police corruption. And that he knows that Allen's, like, surveilling, and he knows that Allen's paying off cops. So we get this validation after the fact. Attempt to open up our case, we can't. And I look like the red light's on.
No, it is.
But for what?
It doesn't look like it. It is. But I don't want to cut you off. I don't want to cut you off in a...
just one more point.
I don't want to just conclude that thought.
You're way over your time.
Yeah, I know.
Way over in the first argument.
I tend to go way over. You're right.
You've got the brief. We'll rely on that.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. Mr. Brayman?
I really don't want to respond to Ms. Brown's cross-appeal argument. I think it's the one time that Judge Castillo did not abuse his discretion in this case, and I'll just leave it at that. But let me address one thing that is clearly wrong that she said, and I think it's disingenuous. The four-piece spicy does not refer to crack cocaine. It was never brought up at the sentencing hearing of John Ecker that it referred to crack cocaine. Judge Castillo never mentioned the four-piece spicy during the sentencing. And if it's there, I'll eat the page. What happened at the trial testimony...
I think that's what she meant. The trial testimony brought that fact out.
It didn't bring that fact out.
That was the question.
And it's completely wrong and it's disingenuous. Alan testified, and we disputed the four-piece spicy had anything to do with cocaine, but that's beside the point. Alan said that Ecker delivered 4 kilos of powder cocaine. He kept two of them. He re-rocked two of them and gave them back to Ecker. Re-rocked is not producing crack cocaine. It's...
What is it?
It's making the cocaine look like it's a higher quality by making rocks as part of... So it's just not powder, but it's lumps. So it makes it look like it's a higher quality of cocaine. There wasn't one witness that testified that four-piece spicy had anything to do with crack cocaine. And if that's the case, why does Ms. Salovar, during Brim sentencing, say that Ecker was only involved in 8 kilograms of powder cocaine?
We'll read it very carefully.
Okay.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. Appointed counsel in this case have an additional thanks of the court for accepting the appointment and representing the defense in this case. Case is taken under advisement.